Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fuckadelics, what the fuck nicks? How's it going? This is Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. Amazing guest today, a woman who I love and adore and am amazed by. Michaela Watkins is on the show today, the actress and hilarious person. And I got choked up talking to her for no reason other than I was just talking to her. Broke my new car in by fucking the door up. Hasn't been a great week. I got to be honest with you. I know I sounded a little dismal on Monday. I feel a little better today. You just have to take these. There's that sting of like, I'm an asshole. I mean, I've got this hybrid Camry now, and I don't always know when it's on. So I parked in my driveway, and I got out of the car, and it started rolling backwards, and the door was open, and it got... And the door snagged on a brick on my wall, and I got into the car, slammed on the brakes and pulled it back up, and I fucking dented the door. God damn it. Brand new fucking car. It's covered with water spots. Now it's got a dent on the fucking door on the edge because I'm an idiot. And it's just sort of like, what's the fucking point? Well, I'll tell you what the point is. I'll tell you the point right now. That's the reason I bought a fucking Toyota Camry. Leased it even. Because you know what? Outside of the sting of realizing that my new car now was a little fucked up, the second thought was, it's just a fucking Camry. It's not a fucking BMW or goddamn dumb Mercedes. It's a fucking Camry because fucking Camrys kick ass. And if they take a hit, you're like, all right, there you go. That's the beginning of the breaking in process of my new Camry. And that's followed immediately by like, God damn it. The fuck is wrong with me? I don't know how to turn my own goddamn car off. Jesus, man. So after Frances McDormand won the Emmy for Olive Kitteridge, I'm like, I should watch Olive Kitteridge. I got locked into that. And I'd say for about, it's a dark bit of business, that thing. It's beautifully acted, beautifully shot, beautifully written. If you're suicidal, if you're not a depressive, I'm not sure you'll enjoy it. But it's an amazing miniseries. The acting is incredible. That dude, is it Richard Jenkins, right? Richard Jenkins, genius. McDormand was a genius, is a genius in it. Bill Murray's in it at the end. There's other great performances. But man, for the first two episodes of that thing, you know, you definitely want to kill yourself. And then something eases in you. It's quite an amazing character. It's an amazing piece on the nature of life and depression, or is it depression, or is it life, or is it Maine? A lot of questions, man, but it was worth watching. I definitely got off on it. I mean, I she's just astounding. I need to talk to her. Hey, if you know Frances McDormand, tell her maybe we could have a conversation. Okay, please. I'm going to go to my girlfriend's big art opening. It's very exciting. Here's what's exciting is if you're dating somebody and you fucking respect what they do, that is an amazing feeling. And it's nothing that you can do. that is even better, because then you can't use it when you're filling your resentment bag, which happens. I'm not saying you got to empty the bag. You should probably empty it into the garbage. Man, you got to disarm that thing. Anyways, I'm getting off the point. The point is that my girlfriend Sarah Kane is a brilliant painter, and I'm excited to go look at her amazing paintings because I'm astounded by them. And I like her pretty well too, but the paintings, joke. She's got a sense of humor, but she takes everything very seriously at first. Speaking of love, it's a different kind of love. Michaela Watkins is one of the most hilarious actresses alive. And she's starring in the new Hulu original called Casual, which is executive produced by Jason Reitman, who's been on the show, who I saw at a party recently. Not dropping names because I was doesn't matter. The Casual premieres Wednesday, October 7th on Hulu. You might know her from Wet Hot American Summer. You might know her from like on Veep, on The Goldbergs, on Transparent. And speaking of Transparent, I just realized this, that Michaela is absolutely amazing in it. And I'm not sure I'd watched it when we had this conversation. I've since watched all of them. And it's some of the most provocative original things I've ever seen anywhere in any medium. I thought it was astounding, amazing all around. But she was great in it. Go Google her face. Saturday Night Live, she did a season. Go Google her face. So before you listen, you can go, oh yeah, that woman, that amazingly hilarious woman, Michaela Watkins. Here we are talking, me and her.
Tomorrow's my 2-year.
2-year anniversary.
Yeah.
How's it going?
It's so great.
It's better?
Yeah, I never thought I would ever be married.
Really?
Yeah, I was engaged for a super long time.
How long?
Years.
What was the excuse that it didn't happen? Because I was in that situation and I ended up getting married. I was in my first marriage. I was engaged for like 6 years, 7 years.
Were you in your 20s?
Oh, that's a good question. I think 20s, late 20s, yeah, early 30s.
I think that's why we didn't, was because I hit my mid-30s, and I think women particularly start to come apart.
When?
I feel like women break apart in their mid-30s, and then they put themselves back together in new ways.
I have a theory about it. Don't you think like 23 is also a breaking apart period, and then you come together, and then you break apart again? Well, how were your early 20s? Weren't they crazy?
My early 20s are a blur because all I was doing was working. Like I was just, all I was doing was the grind, you know? In my early 20s, I had like 3 jobs at a time and half of them involved serving drinks. And so I was in the like bar rock club scene for most of my 20s. And so I was just coming home at 5 a.m. and then I, you know.
Yeah.
Chill out to Teletubbies, because that's what would be the only thing on TV.
I'm thinking a little weed, too.
Probably, you know. But
weed and Teletubbies.
It was just, yeah, I remember when I discovered Teletubbies.
Oh, you're like, does anyone, other adult, know about this? The depth of what's going on here?
I just felt like it had just been so much healing.
Oh, good. You felt like you're on another planet, especially if you were high. You're like, what is the whole pace of it was bizarre.
It was.
And the landscape?
I think that was the first show before Netflix, before the stuff where they actually took time with the drama unfolding. The sun would rise and the sun would set.
I always wanted to see that set. Like, I wanted to go to that set, the Teletubby set. It was just like a golf course almost, wasn't it?
I don't know. It's probably just a bunch of, like, furry fetish people.
Like, oh, yeah. You don't want to know what's inside the Teletubby.
Yeah, you don't. They're just like, would you like to make love under the baby sun?
Yeah, let me put my head on. So I always wonder about that, about the nature of commitment when you just sort of sit in that kind of engagement for, like, years. Because I knew for me, I guess it was easier to be engaged and to actually take the step, but I eventually did.
Oh, you drove it.
Yeah, I eventually said, well, I guess we're getting married. It's time. It's not the greatest proposal.
Wow, that is...
Well, what happened with you guys?
And still actually continue to be, weirdly, but not overnight, really good friends. We were just like buds.
Right.
We were kids in a clubhouse.
Right.
We were like this young... It was the first time I was in a relationship where I felt totally safe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think I liked that feeling so much that I wanted to marry it.
Right. The safety feeling.
I mean, he's a great guy. And he's just... We're not...
That's interesting.
I didn't understand. I mean, when we broke up, when I ended that, yeah. I thought I was going to die. I mean, you think being broken up with is the worst thing, but breaking up with somebody who's a good person and you don't think that you have the right to say no to someone who loves you unconditionally,
right.
you're like, I'm the worst person in the world. I mean, who do I think I am? I'm so lucky to have somebody who's so... you know, supportive and in my corner, but so you just sort of feel like you're taking this huge leap of faith to say, what? Like, I think I can get better or deserve better, you know? And you're just like, you just feel like such a shitheel because, you know, I don't come from that place of like, I deserve. I come from a place of usually of like, I'm lucky if.
Exactly. Like, who would love me? Well, yeah, I know. You're making a big mistake, but if you want to ride it out, I said that last night.
I make a mean frittata.
I said that here was my pillow talk last night. Well, you know, I guess you've chosen to put up with this. That's a declaration of love. You choose.
Just put it on them.
Well, yeah, I'm trying the best I can.
Yeah.
You've decided to tolerate this. So you were with that guy, but you're still friends with that guy.
I am. Like I said, it didn't happen overnight. I mean, it definitely was a mutual...
Was he an actor guy?
Mm-hmm.
Is he an actor we know?
No.
Oh.
And that's the issue, is that he's such a colossal talent. And I would always joke that, you know, he's the artist and I'm the sellout. Because I was, you know, really starting to work at that point, and he... is just such a...
Really? And what's he doing now?
Person. He's working the same gig, but he's got a, you know, a 9-to-5-er.
Yeah.
But he creates these one-man shows that are just, like, stunning.
Great.
They're just jaw-dropping. But it hasn't, for some reason, it hasn't been seen by either the right people or what. I don't know, because everybody who comes to see him is just like, what do you do? He does these, like, sort of pornographic pantomime one-man shows. With narratives.
Pornographic pantomime?
Yeah, it's like
narrative?
Super, super...
Sounds kind of specific.
Yeah, I mean, it's like he'll act out an entire date gone awry. But it's
pantomime.
It's just him. Yeah, words.
Did he train in the French place?
It's funny. Yeah, a little bit. I mean, he went to UW and that's what they do there.
They do
the French stuff.
They do. The real mind
stuff. The Lukaku.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's a pro.
He's excellent.
I think mime in general has a bad reputation. It gets dismissed a lot.
It gets lumped in a...
in a street performer.
In a
silly,
Marcel Marceau.
Yes.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. And people have not revisited it. Sounds like a good special, though. I think Comedy Central should take a chance and do a mime special.
Oh.
An hour.
God.
An hour mime special.
Don't you think? But people get mad at mime. It's not just that they don't care about it. It's like it incites anger, I feel like.
Mimes are getting hit all the time. You fuck. I get it. You're in a box. I've had enough. It's a tough life for the mime. Getting beat up on the street.
It's going to be our next movement. That's when we know we really run out of things to, you know, feel disenfranchised.
Right. Yeah. But it is interesting, though, about the nature of show business and actually making a career in show business. It's not necessarily based on what anyone sees as talent or specific talent. It's sort of perseverance and
delusion, and kind of, I think you have to have this thing inside of you, probably,
right.
That just
childish.
Says, like,
completely childish.
I'm going to keep going, even though, you know, I mean, I guess there's enough things telling me where I'm on the right track, but I'm going to keep going with this. Whereas, I don't know why. I feel like it's an energy shift with him or something. Like if he just moved it somewhere else, it would.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes I think that, but as I get older, I realize, like, you know, I don't know what it is. And if there was a system,
well,
or
As I get older, I realize I don't know anything about anything anymore.
As I get older, I'm not even sure I want to do it anymore.
Get older?
No.
Be a person?
No, just like work.
This. I know. Yeah. I was thinking about you so much, thinking, God, like, just feel like the 19th season of Happy Days for you. Like, after the president was here, I'm going to sit down with another person.
Oh, no, it doesn't. It doesn't, because, like, I get out of this what people get out of talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get out of yourself, you're engaged, mm-hmm. it's interesting, new things happen. You know, like, the president was compelling and exciting, but, mm-hmm. I like talking.
Yeah.
You know, because we don't do it a lot.
I know, I love talking.
So you just connect. But you've sort of become this very go-to specific, like you kind of play where you're funny, mm-hmm. but you're kind of like...
Sad?
No.
Pathetic?
A little mean.
Oh, yeah. I do play a bitch a lot.
Yeah. And I wouldn't say that.
I don't know. I think I have a bitchy face or something. I don't know what it is.
No, because... it's because you can be funny doing it. I mean, it's not like, you know, calling it a bitch character is minimizing it. Because a lot of times there's a lot of heart to it eventually. Like I think the last thing I watched with you in it was the Lake Bell movie.
Oh, In a World?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that movie.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're a difficult character, but you end up being the good person and helping her out, right?
I think that's where being a bitch comes from, isn't it?
Yeah, and enlightened, you were great.
Oh, but, such a bitch.
Yeah, but that you didn't redeem yourself.
She was
in that
not.
One.
She was not enlightened.
No.
She was Yeah.
She was the opposite of enlightened. Yeah. But such a classic sort of character, like just the worst.
I know,
kind
and
of
I
bad
think
bad girl.
I think
character.
That's why I absolutely am drawn to that, because I feel like I get to, you know. I feel like I'm channeling people who've pissed me off and
really?
Hurt my feelings so bad, and I get to sit in their skin and just show the whole world what a fucking asshole they are.
That's good. You're providing a service.
It does feel cathartic sometimes, you know, especially, but a lot of times they
don't always get their comeopance. So
but I like to play through, like when you say there's heart, I like mm-hmm. to play it through, you know what I mean? I guess, like, you know how alcoholics say play through the drink, you know, if you want that drink. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'd like to know. It sounds like a new one, and I know most of them.
Yeah. Somebody said this to me once, and it's sort of, you can use it for anything that feels like a vice in your life, like play through the drink. So take the drink, and then you know, imagine that great feeling. You're like, oh, I love drinks. And then you talk to everybody, and all of a sudden you're 10 times funnier than you were 5 minutes ago, and mm-hmm. you're loose and you feel good. And then you get that second drink, and then, you know, and so on. And then next thing you know, you're like throwing up,
wasted,
showing up late for work, and
you lost
puffy.
A year of your life,
and you slept with the ex again, and
just bad,
still didn't work out.
And now you're living in your car, and you're begging for money. Now you're revisiting mime,
exactly.
The drunk mime,
really. You're breaking out your white gloves, playing these characters. I think by being them, I sort of feel like you can play through, and when you find their heart, you realize, oh, this is, it's like, it's making a wrong right for me in a weird way.
Oh,
like,
right.
Oh, this is why they're a bitch, because they're insecure, or they're, you know, or they're empty, or they don't like their life. They made bad decisions, and they made them from the wrong place, and now they're examining that. Whatever.
Now they're dumping it on everybody else. Yeah.
And so... It's sort of, then you feel compassion for this character, and then then you set it free.
So what do most people recognize you for, though, like when you're out in the world? Because are you one of those people that are like, wait,
are you Jack's ex-girlfriend? I get that a lot. I get, are you somebody's ex-girlfriend? Like, doesn't she remind you of Larry's ex-girlfriend?
Yeah.
He's a friend of ours. And every time I get that, they always... punctuate it with, she was crazy.
and meanwhile, they're just erasing all your accomplishments by not being able to really place you.
Yeah, because I think I appear, you know, recur in a lot of shows that people see, but have, you know, other than the show I'm doing now, not the main event. And so I'm in the back of their conscience.
Well, you work a lot.
I work a lot. And I think that's the thing, is that they see me, but they think they know me. But they can't, because they can't say that one thing. But you know, it depends on who it is. Like, if they have kids, I know they recognize me from Trophy Wife. If they don't, they maybe from Transparent or Indie stuff. You know?
Right.
And then, you know.
SNL?
SNL, Gay Men.
Gay Men.
Yeah, I did a character on there that somehow resonated.
Which one?
With the homosexual population.
Which character?
She played Angie Tempura. She played like a really bitchy blogger who was like a basement dweller.
Well, so where were you? Where were you invented? Where were you?
Syracuse, New York.
Really?
Yeah, and I have to be nice to Syracuse because every time I say Syracuse, I have this like response to say, "Yeah, that's total shithole dump armpit."
Don't do that. And in the age of the internet, you can get a lot of flack.
But what I realized, because I just went back there a few weeks ago.
I'm trying. I lived there when I was a little kid for like a year. I think my dad.
You did?
Yeah. I think he was a resident there, or maybe even earlier, just out of medical school. You know, we were there, and there's just pictures of me in snow.
That's what my dad would always say: "Is like, don't knock it. We have a wonderful medical center."
Yeah.
That's what I remember: is snow, divorce, gawkiness.
I guess
at a very inopportune time.
It doesn't sound like you can hang any of those on actual city.
Well, I mean, we had a mall that felt kind of molesty.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
The molesty mall was it called that?
You know what I mean? It was like the 80s and late 70s, 80s, and so I think molestation was super in at the time.
Oh really?
It just felt like every time it just felt like, because there's not the helicopter parenting thing, and because I was a latchkey kid and all that kind of stuff, it just felt like there was this constant, just an paralyzing fear,
right?
Because I was walking by myself,
like older kids everywhere. Usually, or like old men,
older kids, or people in cars that would just grab me off the street and shove me in a car. You know,
that happen?
No,
okay.
Not that I know of.
Okay,
unless I'm suppressing something major, but it was always a fear. It was it was a constant fear because I think I spent so much time alone.
Yeah,
at such a young age.
Yeah,
I think that I.
Where were your parents?
The club? No, they were.
club.
My parents split when I was 8.
Yeah.
And my mom was a Latin teacher, and then she.
Do you speak Latin?
No, I do not. Much to her chagrin.
Not a lot of Latin in the house.
Not. Right. We only know how to conquer cities in our house, and make proclamations. But she
and read Catholic texts.
Exactly. She's like, I can't raise 3 daughters on a Latin teacher salary. Yeah.
What was your dad doing?
He's a mathematician at Syracuse.
Still?
Yeah, actually.
A mathematician.
He just retired, but he still does, he has research.
Can I just take a couple shots in the dark? Was he emotionally shut down and unavailable?
Oh, real dark shot you took. Funny enough, now that I'm older, this is interesting, but now that I'm older and I look back at them, he actually, yes. I mean, was he shut down? I don't know if shut down. He was just, you know, he had a math brain.
Yeah.
And it was a little spectrum-y.
Yeah.
But I feel like the divorce fired him into more of an emotionally available place.
Oh,
even
yeah.
Even if he was out of touch with... Yeah. Wasn't necessarily in touch with, you know, having what he says when it's reflected in somebody else's face as they don't like it, as understanding like, oh, I might have said something they didn't like. At least he was, you know, introspective.
Right. So he wasn't great at empathy.
No.
But now he's a little more self-aware.
Now he's very self-aware.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I think it triggered this thing that maybe, I don't know if men even did, but he really started to talk about, like, I'm like this, and I do this, and my tendency is that. And then when he met his wife.
The new one.
The new one, that's all they did for years was just say, we're like this, and when I did that. And they just loved to talk about how they came to do things.
So they were completely self-aware, sort of selfish people that talked about it to each other?
I think they were just a little self-obsessed with the fact that for the first time they were discovering human behavior.
Was she another mathematician?
Like, no.
Oh.
No.
So your mom, all right, so you're in Syracuse. You're avoiding molesters. Your
just
parents got
like a full-time job in my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, it's weird. I've never even said this out loud before, but I can't believe how much real estate it took up in my life.
The fear of being taken.
Taken, abducted, followed.
Wow.
You know.
Yeah.
Just because I did. I spent so much time alone. My mom went back to school, so she was working during the day and going to school at night. And it became a sad time. You know, I think of Syracuse as a sad place, but I did just go back there. And what I really realized through my adult eyes was how beautiful it is. I mean, I took for granted that everybody had rolling farms and hills and sheep and cows.
Yeah.
And I was just like, ugh, more farms, you know? Yeah. And now I see, oh, this is what my parents probably thought. This was pretty cool.
Pretty.
Yeah.
Well, now your sisters are older?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you were the youngest one?
Yeah. And there's, you know, six and a half and 8 years.
Why did I have to do a follow-up question?
I don't know. Just, your dad wasn't a mathematician, clearly. But
how big of an age difference?
6.5 and 8 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Between
me. Like, so
you were really...
They're a year and a half apart, and then...
And then you were the, whoops.
No, I was Save the Marriage Baby. Didn't.
So they were already out another, being teenagers.
Already I failed, right out of the gate.
You blew it. But so they were sort of on to their own lives. So you really left, weren't they protective? Weren't they?
No, they were totally onto their own lives. They couldn't wait to, I mean, because they were more sailing, you know, they understood that my parents hated each other. Before I did, because I just thought that was stasis. I thought that's like all parents hate each other.
Yeah.
But they had known my parents had a happy time and then saw it
disintegrate.
So they just tapped out. They were like, my sister, you know, Becca was like, I'm going to go smoke pot and go date, you know.
Yeah.
Ended up dating actually John Fishman, the drummer from Fish.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Before he was big, I guess.
Before he was, his dad was my orthodontist. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
The drummer from Fish's dad was your orthodontist?
Yeah.
And he did your teeth?
Dr. Fishman.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a good trivia.
Yeah.
And both your folks are still around?
Mm-hmm.
So where'd you end up going?
Barely.
After?
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
But you didn't grow up in Syracuse?
So I did. I lived there till I was 14. And then my dad went on sabbatical for a year in Paris. And I went with him and lived there. Yeah. And then I came back and my mom said, I got a job in Boston. You coming?
Uh-huh.
And I said,
Boston.
Get me out of here.
Yeah.
And
when did the acting start?
And the acting started when my mother said, when I was visiting my dad in Syracuse, I came home and she picked me up at the train station or airport or something, whatever. And she said, we were driving back to the apartment and she said, I signed you up for an audition at the community playhouse here. And
in Boston?
Yeah, in Wellesley, Massachusetts, actually.
Wellesley, a little further.
Like, and she said,
half hour out.
Yeah. And she said, so put up or shut up. Because I kind of had...
You talked about it.
Yeah, I talked about it. And I had a grandmother who, you know, she got married when she was 17, but she always said, I could have been a great actress.
Uh-huh.
So I think she...
Planted it?
Yeah.
You're going to do it for her?
I'm doing it for you, Grandma.
What? Whose mother?
I never really knew her. My dad's mother.
Oh.
She was apparently a great beauty. But I actually have some of her portfolios of when she took acting classes, and it was silent film era.
Really?
Yeah, so it's all about how to hold your mouth when you're surprised.
Really?
Yeah, put your hand to your chest and make your mouth a half circle.
These are classes she took?
I'm scared. Yeah. Yeah.
And what, she was in Syracuse?
And I have all her notes. No, she was in New York, Philly.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So that was the dream, to be a silent film star?
Mm-hmm.
Those notes are amazing.
Yeah.
Like a whole book of them?
A whole book of them.
Oh, my God.
I know. I wonder.
How to audition for silent films.
When that mime thing comes back, it's going to be a real relic.
What it feels like you should do some sort of like fun video thing with just doing those exercises. Just reading from her notes.
For people who, suffered a head injury.
No, for yucks. So what play did you end up? Did you get in the play?
I did. I got it. I played Ida the Maid.
Ida the Maid.
I'm Ida. I'm the maid.
You remember the play?
Yeah. I'm Ida. I'm the maid. Like, she has to say who she is.
Yeah.
It's not enough that she's holding a tray.
What play
was I'm
that?
The maid.
I think you could. I think it sounds like you could do that role again. Like, yeah. If you need, what play was
I
that?
I would love to reprise it. It was called "See How They Run." Uh-huh. It was a British farce. Because I was Ida the maid.
And you did the accent and everything?
Yeah. I watched Oliver. I knew how it went.
And that gave you the bug? That was it?
That was it.
You got some laughs?
Yes.
Oh, that's usually how it goes, right?
Yeah.
Feel those laughs.
Well, it was working, you know, it was on a big level now. Because, you know, usually it was just like, you guys are getting a divorce. Look at me. I'll do this.
Yeah.
And so I would entertain my family.
Right.
Because they're not funny. My family, I think they would say we're not funny. My dad's a little funny. He's pretty witty. Yeah.
So you were the show person? You were the person that was like, come on, you guys.
Yeah.
Everything's okay.
Yeah. The performance starts in 7 minutes in the living room.
You did that?
Yeah.
Ah. Can you reprise any of those roles?
Well, I probably, you know what's funny? You know how kids play princesses and like really fantastical, wonderful, beautiful people.
Yeah.
My performance, we had this brunette, like, curly wig in our house for some reason. I think it was some relatives who had it.
Yeah.
And somehow when we were cleaning out their stuff, we procured it. And
yeah.
So my character was, I'm, what was her name? Oh, Consuelos, the put-upon maid.
Uh-huh.
And so.
You like maids.
This was
your wheelhouse.
So it was just me in an apron with this wig on, and I would come out and, in a really surly, mean way, take everybody's order.
Yeah.
And then go in the kitchen and bang pots around and scream and yell at people that weren't there.
Yeah.
And then come back out with, like, you know.
Smiling
with, and plop a plate down. And that was my bit that I would do for the family. They thought it was hysterical.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
As a pitch, it's funny.
Yeah. And I'd come out with a plate and a mop in my hand.
Uh-huh. You know, right.
I had my props.
Yeah. I get a kick out of it hearing about it. I think it's viable.
Yeah. I mean,
You could just call it that, the show. Yeah. Consuela, the put upon maid. What maid is not put upon?
Starring Michaela Watkins and 17 pots.
So, all right. So you're in Wellesley, which is nice. Mm-hmm. The school's there.
That was weird. That was a culture shock, going from Syracuse to Wellesley.
Yeah, I've been to that town. I think I went out there for a party once when I was in college.
For the Wellesley girls?
Yeah, smart women.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good school. I don't remember what happened at the party, but it doesn't matter.
Did you have to keep one foot on the floor at all times?
Yeah, maybe. I remember it was sort of weird. Oh, she had a sweater. That's all I got.
That I got off her.
Yeah, I don't think I got it off her, but I remember it was a big sweater. So a lot of sweater. I can't put it all together. But I knew I was very impressed with the idea that she was at Wellesley, because I was BU, which you're always, you too?
Mm-hmm.
Get the fuck out of here.
I'm serious.
You were BU. Like, BU is like a good school. Not really. It's a good, it's like, if you pay to get, you know, your parents can afford to send you there.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's good, but it, like, you're always, there's this sort of like BU.
I know.
You're just surrounded by better schools. And the whole institution had an inferiority complex, and they had this weird fascist president.
President Silber.
Silber, who
He didn't want anybody to fornicate ever again.
Yeah, but also he just kept buying property through the college and just amassing academics and stuff to compete with the Ivy Leagues.
Well, when I got there, it was the first year they implemented, you know, you couldn't just go to somebody's dorm without... You know, you can just show an ID, and I couldn't go visit you in your dorm. Yeah, you had to. You could only visit people who had your sticker. You know,
right.
So if you weren't already in the dorm, it was really hard to get people into the dorm.
And this was to stop fornication.
Yeah. Yeah.
That couldn't have worked.
Yeah.
No, you find a way.
Yeah.
In a place.
If you have a Sharpie, you just change the letter.
Yeah.
So
after the community playhouse thing, then you start serious about it?
Then I did like a summer institute at BU where you go for the summer and go to, it's a theater conservatory.
Uh-huh.
And so you get kind of a taste of it.
Uh-huh.
I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
I was so aimless then. I was so, I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't, I mean.
Yeah. Do you now?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's what's weird is that it's at a time where I don't know. I mean,
sure. I went to college. I was just sort of like, what can I put together as a major?
Yeah. And how can my SAT scores were such garbage that the fact that I got to audition to go to BU instead of my grades being the reason I got in was 98% of the reason why I probably went there.
Between me and you, I didn't even take SATs.
Really?
I took something else called the ACTs.
Oh, yeah. I remember the ACTs.
Right. I took ACTs, went to a small college that wasn't, you know, very, you know, they went, you know, if you had money, you can go.
Uh-huh.
Curry College in Milton.
Right.
And that, because the only thing I got accepted to at BU when I applied at first was the College of Basic Studies.
Yeah, CBS, and, the Coloring Book School.
I know, I know. So I was like, can't do that. You know, can't do it. So I went to Curry and then I transferred.
Can't bribe silver. Remember when that was the...
No.
Couldn't bribe silver.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's clever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so that's what I did. And I transferred in sophomore year. But I was the same way. Had no fucking idea. Creative people, sometimes they're just sort of like, well, I don't have a career in mind. I'm not very disciplined. Like, there's a million things you could go learn that might help you in the future.
Yeah, and they were all, you know, luckily because my dad taught at Syracuse, I could go there for free. So I did my junior year abroad, and I went to Italy and England, and I got, like I said, I got to go for free, and it was, that's what expanded my mind. And then I came back for my senior year of theater school, and I was like, oh, all of a sudden... Literature actually is interesting to me.
That's
for the
what
first
blew
time.
Your mind?
Well, I had to expand. I mean, what the fuck did I know about love, loss, you know, hatred, envy, all those things? It was just, I was barely coming together as a human person. I mean, I spent all of high school people pleasing, and then here I was in college, suddenly supposed to access deep emotions and doing Euripides and Sophocles and all these inaccessible, you know, things to begin with. And it's just such a, you know, all these 20-year-olds like holding spears and saying these life or death, proclamations, and you're going, this is all bullshit.
Like,
I don't believe you. I don't believe any of you. All we're trying to do is get, you know. It's what's funny is that in my class at BU, you know, we started out as 70.
At the School of Fine Arts.
At the School of Fine Arts.
Which is a good acting school.
It is.
Yeah.
I don't know if it is now. It certainly was then.
It was when I was there.
Yeah, but I don't know. I saw a list. It wasn't even on it. Of the best acting schools, it wasn't even the top 20. But maybe it's because they've changed their curriculum since. Where they, when I was there, they first started something called theater studies. Because before it was a conservatory. And so after your second year, you would either be cut or you would continue on. I got cut. I was cut from the theater school.
Wait, okay, so you go in as a sophomore, right?
No, you go in as a, you started at BU.
You were a freshman at BU.
Yeah. You can barely spell your name by the time you graduate theater school because you only take one course outside of theater a semester. So, you know, I took an English course, but here and there.
Right.
This is a true story. I was sitting in an English class, and this is what a fuck up I was, but I was sitting in an English class and realized about the third class in that I was in English as a second language.
Third class.
Instead of reading Madame Bovary, we had these handout pamphlets with excerpts from Madame Bovary.
That must have been a good moment.
And I look around and I was like, wow, you know, BU is really, I love how it's just international and, you know, what a like beautiful little, you know, hotbed of mixed cultures. Yeah. Wait, what the fuck? I'm the only one here without an accent.
Did you stay the whole course?
Totally. Sailed. A+.
Come on.
First day I ever got.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Where'd you tell them you were from? Syracuse?
Syracuse, Greece. There is a Syracuse, Greece.
There is?
Yeah.
All right, so you're there, you're doing your 20-year-old versions of Greek tragedies and comedies, and you go to Italy and England, and your mind gets blown.
My mind gets blown. It just, you know.
International love affair.
International love affair-ish, not really. I don't know. Just feeling more like there's more layers, you know, to a person than the small world that I had been growing up in.
Yeah.
And then... By the time I was just, I just wasn't a good actress then, you know? Just I wouldn't even say I wasn't good. I was just going to say I wasn't an evolved person yet.
Right.
And I was
Is anybody that gifted?
But there were other people in my class who seemed like they had it handled, you know?
Yeah?
Yeah. And
they could just access it?
Yeah. And the funny thing is the people that I'm sort of thinking of aren't acting now.
Right.
So I was in it for the long game, I think is what it was.
Well, it's interesting. Like, I think a lot of people, and I've grown to not so much respect them, but appreciate their decision. Mm-hmm. Like, I think some people kind of get out and, you know, they pursue it for a little while and they realize, like, this ain't going to go anywhere. They yeah. understand their limitations and the nature of the business. And they're like,
Or maybe they just, you know, they're more evolved and they blow their little, I need to act and
well, yeah,
have
similar.
People watch
yeah.
me. Wad early on and then yeah. and then just say I don't need that, it doesn't
get right it. And they become therapists or massage people,
yeah,
realtors. Yoga instructors, yeah. realtors,
racists. They become racists.
Professional racists.
Yeah.
So you went the whole 4 years at SFA?
Yeah, well, three, because yeah. I took that 1 year abroad,
right? And then you graduate and you're ready to act.
It's like, there you go to New York. And the only thing they sent us off yeah. with was yeah. make sure your headshot is the same size as your resume. Don't let the paper, you know, don't let the flap.
Yeah.
Because it's going to jam. We had a casting director say, yeah. you jam my files when you do that.
That's what you learned? That
so
was the most practical advice?
If I see a resume that's bigger than a headshot, in the trash it goes.
Did she come in and speak to your class?
She did. We went to New York, you know, and we sort of got to step foot into the biz. And
they brought you down there.
Meet industry professionals to mm-hmm. do that, yeah. And I was like, wow, that's a takeaway.
Yeah.
Get a glue stick and a pair of scissors.
That's what you learned.
And you too will join the ranks.
And then what were your special skills on your first resume?
Oh, God. It was like stage combat.
Oh, yeah.
Piano.
Mm-hmm. Can you play?
Uh-huh.
Pretty good?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I used to.
Yeah.
And not anymore.
Oh.
But, I don't know. I think I lied about 12 other things.
Stage combat.
Yeah.
Did you have that class?
French. I speak French, that
sure.
kind of thing.
Yeah. Did you do stage combat?
I did. I got my nose broken in stage combat.
Really?
Over the head foot throw. Knee came down right on my nose.
Someone else's knee.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else's knee.
And it broke.
Yeah.
That must have been an exciting day at acting school.
It didn't displace.
Oh.
I was like, this is when they put it back together in a really awesome way. Because I had my sister, she ran into a parking meter, into a parking meter. And well, she's shorter than me, so it was just yeah. right, and it knocked her out. She came out of the hospital, perfect nose. Because the doctor is like, I don't know, she's passed out. I'm just going
yeah.
to do
what
I
it?
Think is nice.
You want us to de-Jew it? we take the Jew right out of that nose.
We got a Jew-be-gone nose.
Yeah.
So, no. So they're just like, your nose is going to stay Jewy. If not Jewier.
but you could be Italian, I've decided.
Yeah, and I speak Italian now.
You do?
Well, yeah, because I did that semester there.
Really?
Yeah, and then I worked in Italian restaurants for a really long time.
So you could, did you correct people when they'd order?
You don't want that. You want this.
No, I mean like say it properly.
Yeah, no, I think it was confusing because I would say, you know,
yeah.
can I help you? Would you like the Tagliatelle? Con porcini. Va bene, allora, ciao. And so.
They're like, what?
Yeah.
Did they point this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, it's funny. I used to, when I moved here, I worked at this place in Brentwood, this really beautiful, wonderful Italian restaurant.
Yeah.
And I'm one of those dorks that I get really prideful about my job. Like I actually, if I like it, you know, if the product is good, I like it.
Yeah.
I like to sell people the food because
yeah.
I think it tastes so good.
And yeah.
So I liked that job. I don't know. It took me for, they told me to quit. Like they were just like, you're a working actor. It's time for you to leave.
You're too good.
I was like,
you're
but maybe one night a week I come in, we taste wine, it'll be fine. Great. And they said, no, it's time you move on.
Really?
Little bird's got to fly.
Uh-huh.
So, but yeah, I dug it, you know, and I don't know why. I liked it. I liked serving people. It's weird. I liked seeing them happy and eating and
And that's a rare waitress
helping,
story.
And helping them do that. Yeah. I know. Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah. The warm memories about
and
waitressing.
All I deal with in this town are just a bunch of nasty, bitchy asshole waiters all the time. And I'm like, man, I was such a nice waiter.
Yeah.
Such a nice waiter.
Maybe you should start a clinic of some kind.
Maybe. I don't know. I just want to, I feel like I want to pull them aside and say, look, you know, you're fortifying people. That's got to make you feel good. This is so stupid. I don't really feel that way. But no, but I did like that job. And but I would wait all the time on all these, you know, execs around town and everything. And just like a couple months ago, I was on set of my show and the head of
the new show.
Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Casual.
And you're the star?
Uh-huh.
What's it about?
It's about a brother and a sister. So there's another star. Mm-hmm. There's Tommy Dewey, who plays my brother. And it's they have serious intimacy issues, and they're kind of, she's at the sort of bottom part of her life. Kind of when I talked about that my shit bucket time.
Yeah.
She's there.
Uh-huh.
And they're really screwed. They've sort of screwed up their lives because they had horrible role models because their parents were messed up too. It's about a dysfunctional.
And it's on Hulu?
Yeah, it will be. Yeah.
Full series. How many eps?
10.
Really? Doing 10 for Hulu?
Mm-hmm.
It's good.
Yeah. Jason Reitman directed the first two.
It's a good kid.
Yeah. He's an incredible director.
Yeah. I like him. I've had him in here.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's
a
focused guy.
He's intense. But he's no slouch. I mean, that guy knows his shit.
He's got pedigree.
He's got pedigree, but I don't know. I mean, he's a real student of film.
Yeah, no, he's a very bright guy.
Yeah.
Like, I had him and his dad the same week in here.
Oh.
Yeah.
I feel like he told me that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not nepotism for him.
No.
It's he really is the real deal.
What makes a difference when you're working with a director? I mean, what makes you say that? I've worked with a lot of people.
Some awesome directors, and I will say, I like to joke that Jason's my favorite male director.
Uh-huh.
As you know, there's sort of a shortage of female directors, but I feel like I've gotten to work with three of some of the best.
Female directors?
Yeah.
Jill
Soloway.
I would think you'd work more with her. I feel like you guys should be
constantly.
Friends. You do?
Yeah, she's one of my best friends.
Oh, good, good. I'm going to be like, you and Jill should really... You live near each other?
We do.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I met her, she just looked at me and she goes, "Are you Jewish?" I was like, ish.
Yeah.
Because I didn't really identify as Jewish at all. And I love saying I didn't identify as Jewish.
Sure.
But I didn't.
But people identified you as Jewish. But you didn't identify.
They couldn't tell what I was. Right. People look at me and they can't really tell. And I wasn't like, I'm a Jew.
Yeah.
It wasn't until later, actually Jill brought out my Jew. And she goes, "Are you funny?" Which is the worst question anybody can ask you.
Yeah.
Because anybody who's like, "Oh God, I always just want to hug somebody," when they're like, "I mean, I'm funny."
Yeah.
I'm like, "No, you're not." Just by that alone. So she said, "Are you funny?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't know. No, probably not."
Mm-hmm.
And then she's like, "You are. You're funny. I can tell."
Mm-hmm.
And so then she said, this is the first second of meeting her. Then she said, "I think you're my muse." And she wasn't wrong. I mean, I would sit in her living room, you know, we would drink or smoke, and I would tell her stupid ideas, and she'd say, "That's funny, I want to shoot that." And so we started doing these Funny or Die things, and then she did her short film, and then, you know, and then
so you were there
Delight,
the,
and then Transparent.
Through the big Jill Soloway.
For the director 2.0.
Explosion.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just crazy. Okay. I'm going to tell you a story.
Okay.
That's going to just...
All right.
I don't know if this has never happened on any set I've ever been on. So the episode I was in was in a flashback at a cross-dressing camp.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you saw it, but Bradley Whitford and Jeffrey Tambor, it's like set in the mid to early 90s.
Uh-huh.
And they go to this camp that actually existed. And so they had all this background people in drag. And I don't know if they were picked because they're transgendered or if they're... I don't know if they just had good faces and they thought they will look good as feminine. And so, but either way, it was just, you know, the whole place was filled up with everybody and they looked great, the background. So normally when you're on sets, you know, the background is just sort of barked at and told what to do, and they kind of pantomime really badly, and it always sticks out weird, and you're watching the edit going, good God, why, what's that guy doing? Like,
he's doing it again.
You know, and that's really what I watch when I watch TV, which is very rarely. It's exactly, all I do is watch, because everybody, every time you see background actors, they're never going, no. They're always agreeing. They're always at a restaurant going, oh, yeah? Oh, uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, oh, right, yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. They're never back there going, no. No.
Standing up and walking out.
Yeah. Good. I don't think so. Arms crossed going, no. So it was like, look how agreeable that guy is. Mm, oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, right. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
So so she comes out. They said the director wants to talk to everybody. So she comes out. She says, you know, everybody, 2 years ago, my father came out as trans, and I'm making this show to make the world a safer place for him. And we're making art, and there is no running out of time, and there is no running out of light, and there is no action, and there is no cut, and there are none of those violent words, those male like filmmaking words. There's none of that here. Here, there is only connection. We're timeless. When I look at paintings, I always look at the crowds. It's my favorite part. And when I watch films, she says, my eye always goes to the sea of artists that are, you know, populating the background, because that's the world that you guys are building. And then she says, you guys are moving art. And then she wheels in a giant TV and plays clips that she had edited together of Italian films where the camera just moves through the background of these people at a party and just these crazy, interesting faces and everything like that. And then the background gives her a standing ovation, because it's the first time they've been talked to like they're human people, probably. And then she says, okay, just start walking around. You know, why are you here? How many years have you been here? Who do you know? Like, is that your cis wife? Is that your, did you bring your wife? Can you bring your wife? Is your wife cool with it? Is that person, how long have you been trans? Are you transitioning? Are you in hormone therapy? Like, has that not happened yet? Are you, you know, how do you feel about the food? Everything. Yeah. Do you know the caterers? Yeah. Who's that waiter?
Yeah.
Is that your friend?
Yeah.
You know, are you embarrassed by them? Blah, blah, blah. Are you shy? And everybody just started moving around this big, giant, you know, 100-person improv that was happening. And without ever saying action, the cameras just started to permeate the crowd. And after, you know, 4 days of shooting in this manner, everybody, by the time they got to the big party scene, everybody was just leaving it all on the floor, to the degree that she said, she had this idea that she wanted to have a choreographed dance where Jeffrey Tambor would emerge out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she said, who here knows how to choreograph or anything? And one woman was like, I do, and I'm a dancer. So she...
This is
a trans woman, uh-huh, raised her hand and brought everybody out. 50 people. She grabbed, mm-hmm, 50 people,
yeah,
went outside, and then we kept shooting. And then an hour later, they come back in and execute a perfect dance.
Huh.
And then Jeffrey emerges out of it. I mean, people were just sweating and crying and hugging, and everybody looked drunk, and everybody looked like they'd just been partying their faces off. And she got it. I mean, but they also were part of it and,
yeah,
felt so, so empowered. I was so impressed with that.
Were you in that scene?
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds like one of those kind of most amazing moments of your creative career, in a way.
It's definitely, you know, I think you pick up along the way things that you would, you know, take for yourself and use in your, when you do it. And
it sounds
that's
completely
for sure
unique and, mm-hmm, embracing and creative in a way that you don't really hear about. That she knew exactly what she was looking for and how she went about it was in a very sort of collective way.
Yeah. And it's how she, she's not ego driven. You know, she didn't do it because she needed to be revered. That's how she does every single scene, whether it's with 2 people or 200 people. She just like horse whispers you before it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you shoot it and you're operating from just this other place.
It sounds like honest, authentic collaboration.
Yeah. And it's unlike anything I've seen before. So she's a real visionary, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've done improv though. I mean, yeah, to appreciate, but to sort of see it as an improvisation and on that level.
And she embraces my improvisation. I mean, I think that's what it is. She doesn't, you know, even though she's a writer, she's like, this script is just a roadmap. Throw it out. You know what happens in it. Just you do it.
Mm. But it's interesting because I think a lot of people associate improv specifically with comedy. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think there's a whole other area of improvised theater that has nothing to do with comedy necessarily.
Right. I know. And it's actually more interesting to me.
Oh, of course. Why wouldn't it be? It's just one of those things where it's like the name, the word, it's like, we're going to improv now. Mm-hmm. Can we get a profession? You know, like, or even.
We're going to play a bunch of archetypes.
Right.
Like, I'm a coach.
But even with a Herald, you know, with a mm-hmm. good one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that thing, they can run the gamut, the sort of higher level, more, you know, sort of stripped down improv exercises that aren't party games. Mm-hmm. You know, there can be a lot of emotional stuff in there, but it's still a context. It's still like Second City. It's still, you know, Groundlings or whatever. Mm-hmm. But Groundlings, you were in that?
Yeah.
But that's mostly sketch, isn't it?
It's both. I mean, it's certainly both. But to get to sketch, you have to learn to improv because obviously that's where you start to write from.
Is that where you learned how to act?
I feel like, I kind of feel like it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, for me, learning to act was to do, not mm-hmm. to go to school and break it down into its, like, different parts. Although I understand now, like I said, as an adult, I understand why they teach it that way. But I didn't have the brain capacity for that. You can only break it down once you've been out there doing it a little bit and realize, oh, how does this part work with this part? I mean, It imagine if somebody gave you all the parts of a car, but not a car.
Right.
They're just like, about like, this is this sure. and this is that. And you're like, I can't even conceptualize what this is until I've been driving a car for a while and go, oh, that's what makes that sound, you know?
Well, it's interesting to me that, you know, I talk to actors a lot and, mm-hmm. and it's difficult when it comes down to, you know, what's your craft?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, a lot of acting is just a natural thing in a way. You know, either you have a knack for it or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't do a lot of training. And a lot of people don't necessarily have a lot of range. I mm-hmm. mean, there are people that are like, you know, meticulously trained actors that work all the way, work from the outside in mm-hmm. and know all those tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Stage actors, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are people that are just sort of organic, that everyone's going to come to it how they're going to come to it.
Yeah, and I think that was the other thing, is that when I was at BU, and, you know, like I said, I understand why they do what they do now. But at the time, it just wasn't a fit for me because they really, what they wanted to do was beat out my instincts and replace it with
technique. Yeah.
And what has been my way into this field has been my instincts.
But also, like, it seems to me that, like, you know, if I look at just your resume, I don't know what happened directly after BU or what the struggle was. I mean, where did you end up?
God, I ended up in Portland, Oregon for 5 years. And I guess,
oh my God,
I would say that's where I really learned to act. Because then I just doing, like I said, I was bartending at rock clubs or I was doing theater. And I was doing a ton of theater.
And it wasn't, it was, you know, it was theater for theater's sake in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, the stakes weren't necessarily high other than doing the show.
They were high because they actually, people go to see it there.
Sure.
Unlike here.
But it was honest.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, you knew you weren't going to make your break out of Portland.
I was still kind of drinking the Kool-Aid that I was going to be like a classically trained actress, even though... Because I was doing a lot of Shakespeare and whatnot there, but it was never the match, you know? And
right.
I remember sitting backstage during Winter's Tale, and I just looked up and I said to everybody, I'm going to move to Los Angeles and go be on a sitcom. And they were like, why would you do that? First of all, LA is gross, you know, We're doing Shakespeare. What?
Right.
Sitcom is bad. That's like hack. It's cheese. It's crap. And I'm like, no, that's going to be my way. I understand it. I understand that language more than this one.
Uh-huh. So. But it was part of you like realizing that there was a career there possibly?
I just knew probably much like Grandma Esther, Mama Mester, that if I didn't find out, I was going to regret it my whole life.
And when did you move down here?
In 2000.
Uh-huh. And what were the first roles?
Commercials.
Uh-huh.
It was all commercials at first. And then my first role was on Charmed.
Uh-huh.
Or as I called it, my friend and I called it, Tits with Witches.
Were you excited?
I was so excited. I was so excited. And then I read my first comment about it, and it said, that woman looks like Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Oh. It's not. I guess it's not a horrible thing to say, other than she's 50 years older than
if
you.
They said that woman is as smart as, that would right. have been one
or,
thing.
Or maybe Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she was 25.
Yeah, but they left that part out.
Oh, yeah. Well, you don't read comments. I hope you earned that.
Well, of course.
And then it just sort of started after Charmed, and you just kept showing up. I mean,
I did Grey's Anatomy. This is all in part thanks to my friend Krista Vernoff, who wrote on both those shows and got me an audition.
Uh-huh.
And I went to college with her. There's something BU gave me, Krista Vernoff.
That's nice.
And then I just, at Groundlings is when I made my SNL
Who was with you at Groundlings?
Connection. Kristen had just left for SNL when I came into Groundlings, when I joined the main company. So Jim Rash, Nat Faxon, actually Melissa McCarthy was there.
Good crew.
Steve Little. Yeah, it was great. Great people.
You laugh a lot.
Really, Stephanie Courtney. Laugh. It's my happy place. I mean, it's so. I did stand up for a little when I was waiting for the next level at Growlings, and while I loved it, and there wasn't anything that deterred me from it, other than the fact that I found it a very lonely art.
Uh-huh.
But I like to collaborate. I like to be with other people. I just really love them. It's just, I have such a huge place in my heart for the Groundlings because it was so much laughter.
Do you work out?
I do. I go and do improv shows there a bunch. But I whenever I'm back in that room, I just feel like I'm in the womb again, you know, because it's just, you get it. I mean,
sure.
it's people who can insult you horribly and it's the best. It's like the best sounding insult because it's so good.
Yeah,
it's such a good one.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
So when you get pulled up to the big leagues, how did that unfold? The SNL story.
It was a two part story. I submitted a tape and I went and then I got called to go test there with a few other Groundlings.
Yeah.
Mikey Day, Ariane Price, Edie Patterson, and we all went, and you know, I felt like it went well, as well as it could.
Yeah.
And then it didn't happen. I think they hired Casey Wilson that year. And so then a year later,
were you heartbroken?
No, I was like, I just wanted to be asked to the prom. I didn't have to actually go.
Right. Yeah,
I just wanted somebody to be like, I just wanted somebody to want me to go.
Right.
And that was enough, you know.
Did you meet Lauren then, or?
I saw him. He was on the other side of a room.
Yeah.
Then a year later, I was at the bank machine. I was at the Chase Bank in Burbank. And I get a call saying they want to fly you to SNL to test again tomorrow. Tomorrow. I had 24 hours notice. I was like, what? Uh-huh. And they said, yeah, they just want to. Because I knew I was hearing about people going again.
Yeah,
and
it
always, whenever you hear about people going, you sort of feel like that wistful, like, oh, that's so exciting. And and they might get it, you know? Like, they might get it.
Right.
And then I didn't have all new material, you know? I mean, it'd been a year, but it's not like I was out there creating characters all year.
Right.
I had 24 hours to pull them together, too. And even if you have characters, what are you going to say? What part? I can't do a 5-minute sketch for each character. So I don't do impressions I guess I do, but that's not what we do at Growlings. We're not an impression theater.
Right.
It's all original. So so I was totally freaked out, but it was the best gift because if they gave me 2 weeks to prepare like they did everybody else,
stuff crazy,
I would have just imploded.
Yeah.
I would have done some like really bad, you know, it wouldn't have been loose.
But you felt like you were ready though, right? You knew you could do the gig.
I knew I could do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I had just things written on my hand, literally.
What?
And
what was written on your hand?
On the plane, I thought about doing Andie MacDowell. Like, if she was, I always, when I would sit in Jill's living room, I would pretend to be Andie MacDowell, you know, get a little stoned, and I pretend to be Andie MacDowell auditioning for a film where she was being held by terrorists. And it would just be to make Jill laugh, right? Where I'd just be, don't do that. Don't point that gun at me. It was just... And so all I had were bits that I was doing to make my friends laugh. And I didn't want to repeat, because I didn't want to repeat. Right. They already saw them.
Yeah.
So the honed characters that you know inside out, I couldn't do. And then Arianna Huffington had been in the restaurant where I was working like a week earlier, and I was imitating her at the bar to make my patrons laugh, you know? So I thought, well, I'll do Arianna Huffington.
Right.
So I go there, I go to New York. Are you burnt out on everybody's SNL story?
No, no, it's I like them.
I will say they're all different.
They are.
Every time I hear them. You know what's interesting? I was listening to Jenny Slate on your show.
Yeah, I love
and
her.
And she replaced me. I mean, when I got let go, she came on.
Oh, sorry.
And it was really, it was really amazing, because I was walking around my house, kind of puttering around, doing stuff, listening to it. And it's sort of like hearing from the woman your boyfriend dumped you for as they're falling in love. Do you know what I mean? Like hearing her story, and she got very emotional in the room, and I started to cry for her because I knew exactly that feeling of when she got it. I too, felt like I was chosen by that really wonderful man, you know?
Yeah.
And I too was like, felt all the validating specialness that she was experiencing. The trip, the mind trip was like, oh, wait, this was all happening while I was being broken up with, you know? That's what was so surreal, because it was like this car accident of hearing her side of it, and it's just, and I just was, my heart was so full for her, because I just was like, yes, you did it. Like, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Are you crying?
A little.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Oh, I love you so much right now.
Why?
I just love you. That is so, like, you're so empathic.
Well, I just, you know, I remember that whole story, but that to hear it framed like that, that feeling you must have had to know that, you know, that was the one, you know, after you. Now I need a fucking Kleenex.
It's not even that tragic.
It's a good story, right?
It really is, you know.
So, all right, so.
So, but, so here's my version of mine. I fly to New York. I fly with Liz Feldman. And I meet her on the plane. We're sitting next to each other. And I'm like, oh, hey, I know you. And we turns out we're both going there to audition for us. Here we are sitting on the plane next to each other.
Right.
I'm afraid of flying.
You think that was planned?
Sure it is.
Yeah.
It's just like, let's mine. Fuck you.
Yeah.
So we're sitting next to each other. What they didn't plan on was that we got along like gangbusters. We got super drunk on the airplane because I'm afraid of flying, and I think she's a little trepidatious. I'm just overall nervous.
Yeah.
I'm hammered. We're going to, test the next day. We arrive, what you do is you pace around your hotel room, just like running it. And I never got all the way through it, you know, once without stopping and going, wait, what? You know, so that's when I was like, I have to write this on my hand. Went to this comedy club. So these comics are on stage, and then all of a sudden, Lorne Michaels, Seth Meyers, you know, you just see the comics, like their face just go, this is the day that this is on my vision board. Yeah. This is the day that they all walk in while I'm about to do my set. And they were just like, I have to get back up there. And you saw them all jockeying to try to, and we were all just waiting. And then they said, okay, just wait here. And then without telling the audience, oh, by the way, we're going to stop the narrative of, you know, stand-ups who come out here and tell jokes to your face. Without them telling anybody what was happening, all of a sudden we're going to parade six women here, one at a time, who are going to come out for 5 minutes and do characters. Like, just do characters.
Right.
So I'm sure the audience was like, what the fuck is happening?
Right.
Why is that woman putting on different wigs and talking in silly voices? You know? So I'm waiting, and I'm just, you know, shitting a brick. But this is not my first rodeo now. I just did this a year ago.
Right.
And
but not in that place.
Not in that place. Yeah. Not in this kind of, not with this kind of pressure. Yeah. I mean, again, day before, and everybody else there had had weeks. And I was like, what's that?
Right.
And so the woman goes out before me, and she does Ariana Huffington. She does an Ariana Huffington.
Right.
Ariana Huffington. Who knew who Ariana Huffington was in 2008?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm from California. She ran for governor, but beyond that,
so you're
left, right,
out.
And center.
Yeah.
The audience also doesn't know who Ariana Huffington is.
So it tanks.
And so it's not swimming. It's not sailing.
Yeah.
And now I have to go out there and do Ariana Huffington after it already didn't work.
How many between you?
I'm next.
Wow.
I'm about to launch. I'm about to go, and I hear her go do Ariana Huffington. I'm like, oh, are you kidding me?
Okay. So what'd you do?
So I went out and I said, you know, okay, since you love her so much the first time, I'm going to do Ariana Huffington again, you know, and then I don't know what was inspired, but I just started to talk about how, like, you know, why would you care who I am? It's just politics.
Yeah.
The audience was laughing because I was just acknowledging that, they had no idea who she was and why would they care about politics?
Right.
You know, there's only
two
wars going on. Like, who cares? Right.
Right.
And so it was nothing that I planned that was working. It was only just the stuff that I was able to improvise in the moment. And I don't know if that is what helped move it.
But you had a good set.
I had a good set. It worked out. Like, they liked the Andy McDowell bit. They liked the whatever lady, I can't remember who she was.
Mm-hmm.
And then right afterwards, Liz Feldman and I decided we're going to go across the street and have a scotch. So we walk across. There's a lot of alcohol in my SNL story for some reason. But we walk across the street and we, you know, sit down with our drink. And we're like, you know, just because you're still.
Sure.
Regardless,
As an actor in that situation,
and knowing like two times and not getting it is a, like the first time not getting it was fine, but the second time now I really want it, but also it'd just be a bummer not to seal the deal. But so I'm sitting there, I just so happen to glance at my phone and it's ringing and it's a New York number.
Yeah,
so I answer it, sitting right across from Liz, and. It's one of the producers, and she's like, are you still close by? You know, Lauren wants to have a drink with you. And I was like, And they're like, why don't you come back to the club? And I was like, okay. And then I hang up the phone, and I'm looking at Liz like, this is the worst.
the worst, best moment of your life?
Worst experience. Like, what? She looks at me. I go, I have to go? And I'm just hoping that her phone rings too, and they're like, yeah, are you still close by?
You know.
And she's like, okay. And I go, and I just put my hands on her hands, and I said, what's about to happen is really one of the most awkward things I've ever had to sit through. And this is going to be really, really funny when you're telling this story on, you know, late night show, which you will.
Yeah.
I have no doubt.
Yeah.
And by the way, she has since become so successful, but I said, but right now I have to go. And she's just like, okay. And she was so cool about it. And I said, okay, I'll see you later. And she said, okay, bye. And so I, you know, sort of tail between my legs, just kind of walk out the bar and walk across the street. And
your tail came up though.
My tail like started
out.
To fluff up a bit, and like fuck her, let's go. So that I get across the street back to the club, and and they say, Lauren decided to go home or something.
No,
yeah. So I was like, okay, but all the other producers and Seth Meyers were in my Mike Shoemaker.
Yeah,
we're like, okay, let's go get a drink though. Let's like go talk and. So we walk across the street and we go to this bar, but it looks kind of full and loud. So they go, you know, let's go to this one.
Yeah.
They go to the one.
Where Liz is?
Where Liz is. I swear to God. And I'm like, oh God, please. Oh God, no. Please, God, no. But you are so powerless in that moment. You're like, I just do whatever I'm told.
Right.
Because I'm sort of floating right now between two worlds.
Right.
And so we walk through and they just go walking in and Liz is, you know, at the table on her phone, probably being like, this crazy shit just happened.
Right.
And we all like single file walk right by her. And I look at her going, I just shrug like, I'm sorry. Yeah. There's 100 kinds of sorry I right. felt. I just wanted to drill a hole in the floor and climb into it and yeah. not come out. So we sit down and Seth Meyer said to me, well, there's two ways to get on this show. The really, really easy way and the really, 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 really hard way. And if you get on the show, it's probably going to be the really, really, really hard way. And I was like, okay. He goes, we loved you last year. Yeah. Sorry it didn't work out.
Right.
You know, but they weren't promising anything, but they certainly made me feel really appreciated.
Yeah.
And that was great. And they all just said such nice things and said they'd see me at the Growlings. And it was nice, you know.
Yeah.
And then, so I kind of floated back to my hotel. And then a month goes by, 2 months goes by. And they weren't kidding. I mean, I was getting on the really, really hard way.
Mm.
So then a week after Obama got elected, I was working on the show New Adventures of Old Christine. And
she's great. You love
she's
her.
She's great. And she was on SNL, yeah. funny enough. So I kept getting calls from an NBC switchboard.
Yeah.
Because when I called back, it would go to an right. NBC. And I was like, what is this? Finally, but I wasn't getting a message because my phone kept running out of juice and it wasn't connecting with the voicemail
right.
enough.
It wasn't ringing.
So we're doing the live, not the live tape, but the taping of the show. And finally I have a little break in the taping and I run back and for some reason we had a big cast. So they put me in this other building far right. away and my phone had to charge. So I couldn't be with my phone and I go back there and I call and they're like, oh, sorry, Lauren wants to talk to you, but you just missed him. Can he call you back? And I'm like, yes, but every time I took my phone off the thing, because it was a
right.
piece of shit phone, it kept dying.
Yeah.
So I had to keep it charged over there. And I was like, and then as soon as I get off the phone, they go, Michaela, we need you on set. And
oh,
so
my
then
God.
I go to set. And so this went on for 3 hours. That whole taping was a blur to me because I was like, what is happening?
Yeah.
And then finally, right before curtain call, I connect with Lauren.
Yeah.
And he says, hi, Michaela. And I said, hi. And he said, and I know people, I thought this is when he's going to ask me to come meet him. Because I know everybody sits down and meets him.
Right.
And he said, wanted to see if you can come out tomorrow for the table read. We have the table read tomorrow. Yeah. And it's so freaking cryptic. And I go, does this mean what I think it means? And he goes, yes. And then I was like, well, what if I'm thinking it means?
Right. Still not clear.
What does he think I think it means?
Right.
And so then he says, I said, well, I mean, how long should I plan to come out for? Because I'm coming to, you want me to fly me tonight or tomorrow? It was already 9 o'clock at night. I was like, how long should I, in LA?
Yeah.
And I said, how long should I plan to come out for? And he said, hopefully a very long time. And I just was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. And I just said, thank you. And I was so effusive. Thank you. I think you're, I just said everything stupid that I'm sure he's heard so many times, but I'm like, I think you're just really a great person. Really love your show. Big fan, you know. This is, I couldn't even talk. I hang up. I call my mom. I start crying. And she's like, what? Nobody ever gives you the reaction you want in my family, which I should anticipate. But she's like, who? Why? What? For how long? And then the next phone call I made was to get somebody to cover my class the next day. Because
I was
teaching improv. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was the weirdest thing to come from. Oh, hey, I just got on SNL and you're the second person I'm talking to about it. I need a sub. So I go out to do the curtain call, and right after the curtain call, I turn to Julie and I go, I just got hired on SNL. And she grabbed me and she hugged me and she said, we're getting a drink right now. We need to talk, you know.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
She got to give you the lowdown?
Yeah. She's like, so she gave me the what. And it was all magical, and it was a blur because I had two cats, you know.
Yeah.
I'm leaving the next day. Like, they were just evil. I mean, everybody else has, like, they get hired in the summer, they have a month to find an apartment. I was going, then I'm like, I have a life.
Why
I'm also 36, almost 37 years old. I mean, it's not just a life. Like, I'm a very adult person at this point, you know.
Yeah.
And so
what did Julia tell you?
She said a couple of things. She did say it was a different atmosphere when she was there, and it's much better now because she had gone as a host. Uh-huh. And she just said, you know, this writer's there. You know, they're good. This writer, I think, is still there. Avoid, you know, I don't know.
Oh yeah, like, just practical stuff.
No, just yeah, and just kind of. I think she just wanted to be like, look, you know, you're. I think she wanted to kind of just say, you're a good person. Don't let it fuck with you. Don't let it fuck right. with your head.
And did it?
Of course.
You were on for a season?
I did one season, and I felt like it went pretty well. I mean, all I had to compare it with is what I'd seen just right. as a viewer, you know? And I felt like, oh, for first season, you know, not too shabby. Got to do a bunch of updates and, you know, had some recurring characters yeah. and stuff like that. And I was hired with Abby Elliott, who was 21, and I was 36. Like I said, I turned 37 a month after I got there. I'm 15 to 16 years older than the girl I'm sharing an office space with.
Yeah.
And she's a beautiful, beautiful young woman,
yeah.
you know, and I just felt like such a haggard old person there. I mean, I'm not trying to elicit a, oh, I'm really being honest.
Right.
Like, I really felt like, why didn't this happen 5 years earlier?
Right.
Because there's some things I noticed that felt a little like, this is a little like middle school, but if it was 5 years earlier, I wouldn't have cared,
right.
you know?
Yeah.
But there were moments where I was like, I'm kind of too old for this shit, you know? And I don't mean the comedy. I just mean the way things get run. For example, I went to an after party and I was really good friends with Jason Sudeikis.
Yeah.
And neither of us had anybody coming to the show. So, you know, they'd take you to a car to the after party and we were kind of chit-chatting. We kind of went in one car because why take right. two cars and sit by yourself? And, you know, we're in the middle of conversation and we walk up to the desk and, you know, it's like the producer's assistants kind of seat you. And I don't know if you know the way it sort of works,
no.
the after party, but there's, you sort of get the lay of the land pretty early on. At the center of, at the inner what am I trying to say? The
sanctum.
Inner sanctum is Lorne and the exec producers. Then there's like this little ring around them that is the senior members of the cast, you know,
right.
Fred Armisen, Will Forte, Kristen Wiig. And then after that is like the mid-level, you know, been there sort of the medium amount of time, Sandberg,
yeah.
Hader, Sudeikis. And then around that is the featured players, me, Bobby Moynihan, Casey Wilson,
yeah.
and Abby. And then outside of that is... outside of that ring is the writers, and that's how they sort of seat you in the restaurant at the after party.
Uh-huh.
And so when we walked up, I remember saying, "Oh, you know, hey, can we sit together? Because you know we don't have anybody with us, and we're just hanging out."
Yeah.
And they just sort of looked at us and went, "Okay, hold on a second. You guys want to sit together?" And we're like, "Yeah, yeah. Well, what's the big deal?" I'm thinking, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, can you give me 1 second? Okay. And you could just see, like, they were just, where do we put Michaela? Like, do we make Jason sit with the featured player area? Or do we make, you could just see, like, or do we put Michaela with the, you could, and I was like, where I come from in the Groundlings, like, we're one.
Yeah.
There is no hierarchy. There
right.
is no, and I just, my mind couldn't get around. It wasn't coming from the cast. It wasn't coming from the writers. There's so much love and support, I have to say.
Right.
Like, it was a really, really nice group of people.
Yeah.
Hands down, like, the writers were just unbelievably terrific people. And the cast was a really solid, wonderful, lovely, lovely bunch of people. It wasn't coming from there. It was coming from this other, like, higher level
yeah.
that was sort of instilling this, be a little off balance, be a little, know your place. Like, you have a job where you feel like it's the center of the universe, but we're going to constantly remind you you're nothing. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like these two, this duality that was
yeah.
happening. And I just kind of just felt like, come on, really?
Yeah.
Let us sit together. I mean,
right.
and we ended up sitting together, but I could feel the friction. That,
wow.
And it was just, I can't even believe I'm telling this because it was sort of, I don't want them to sound bad or look bad, but it just struck me as a bizarre way to run a group of people. Like, I don't think it is the best way to get people to be their most creative, you know.
Well, I'd always heard, that it could be a competitive environment, and it mm-hmm. was, you know, a sort of...
But it's not coming from the other...
No, I know. No, I've never heard that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we're performers, mm-hmm. and ultimately the desire to perform, mm-hmm. Given the opportunity, is going to perhaps strain or destroy alliances,
mm-hmm.
but not unlike middle school.
But you do see, I mean, you can feel like who's hot that day at the table
sure,
read,
yeah.
and you can feel who's not. And I mean, Casey Wilson to me is such an incredibly funny writer, and I would crack up so hard at her stuff because I was new and I didn't know, like, who are we laughing at
yeah.
now, you right. know, and you could just feel in the room that there was like a, you know,
ugh.
a tide of who
but it's interesting that, you know, at the age you were at, you had some hindsight and you had some life experience, and I was
past that stage where I was like, went through that, like, I'm gonna kill myself, I just ended my life with
or
this.
That you'll do anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was coming out of, you know, that huge breakup that
yeah.
I was telling you about,
yeah.
and my best friend had just died. Yeah. And so I was not in my totally right mind probably either, you know. I think I was like just on the other side or in the middle of a lot of grief.
Right, and that's life.
Uh-huh.
That's sad about your friend.
Yeah, she had cancer.
Oh, and okay, so, well, how did it end?
So, it ended when I was back in New York. I came out here to do a film, and then I went back to New York, and I'm in my apartment, and I was just thinking, oh gosh, you know, I can't wait to, oh gosh, oh, look yeah. at me, here I am in New York. No, I was thinking, I can't wait to come back and not be new anymore, because
right.
I just spend so much time, like, making sure you're not fucking up all the time
right,
as a
right.
new person, because you don't know.
Oh, and then managing all this, like, hierarchy shit.
Yeah, and I like Lorne a lot, I respect
yeah.
him, but I didn't want to be, here's the thing, I didn't want to... I thought our relationship would happen organically. So
yeah.
I never pushed one with him.
Right.
I never kissed ass. And I was really intimidated by him, but I felt like over time, I'm going to get to know him as a person and he'll get to know me as a person. And I trusted that would happen.
Right.
So I don't think, I never kissed ass or
right.
anything. I never seeked people out. And every once in a while, you know, one of the cast members is like, you should go thank Lorne, go say hi to Lorne, you know, make sure you stop by. Or maybe not the cast, but sometimes the other producers
uh-huh.
be like, you should go say hi to Lorne. And I'd walk up to his table and be like, hi. And he's like, hello. And I'm like, how are you doing? Are you having a good time? I'm like, yeah, I am. I'm really happy to be here. I like your tie. Okay. I'll talk to you later. Okay. Goodbye.
But so the real reason why you didn't necessarily kiss ass is that, you know,
I wasn't good at it. And also, like Bill Hader said, you know, the fact that you're going to go do this movie and he's letting you off to go do this movie or whatever.
Which movie?
It was Backup Plan.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you should thank Lorne, because, you know, I one time didn't, and I could tell, I don't know, maybe it bothered him. I don't know.
God.
He didn't know, you know, but he was just like, maybe you want to, you know. And I just was walking down the hall, and you sometimes see him coming.
Yeah.
And every part of me is like, go the other way, just turn on yeah. your heels, go, run, move. But I was like, no, I'm gonna take Bill's advice. I'm gonna go thank him, you know. And by the way, Bill was incredibly sweet. I mean,
yeah.
he didn't have
great
to.
Guy.
People
yeah.
don't usually give advice
yeah.
there. It was
yeah.
really nice of him too. So I know it was coming from a nice place, but I went over to Lorne, and it was without any, like, you know, warming into a conversation. I was like, hi, Lorne, I just want to say thank you so much for letting me do this movie. I am really excited to go do this, and you're just very nice. And also, do you have a lot of shirts like that? I like that one. It's very nice on your body. Okay. And he just kind of looked at me and he went, okay. Like, just okay. And I was like, this guy hates me. And he never, I never had that one-on-one where I sit down in his
yeah.
office and he gets to
good.
Know me as me. So it's just, I could never, I always misfired every time I talked to the guy.
Yeah.
And,
so what happened?
So then, so I was back in my apartment thinking it'd be nice not to be new.
Right.
You know, just to come back with a little more relaxed and not have to be the best version of myself 24/7. And then I found out that, I think Casey called me and she's like, was your contract renewed? And I was like, no, I mean, I haven't heard it. No, why? She goes, everybody's contracts were renewed. I was like, oh, that's weird. So then, you know, I made the necessary calls and they said, they told my manager, of course we're going to renew Michaela. We're just seeing how things are going to move around. But of course we are. We love her. We're going to. And then like a month later, I thought I would, I just remembered this. I thought, well, maybe if I talk to Lorne, like show him I'm a person and not this creeper that's like every time I see him, you know, starts sweating profusely and talks really fast.
Yeah.
Maybe if I just tell him why I feel like I should come back and why this is important to me and how happy I am to be there. Maybe I haven't told him that. Maybe he just needs to hear. Maybe he thinks I have better things to do. Maybe he thinks, you know, I don't know. I don't know what he thinks.
Yeah.
Truth is, he probably doesn't think anything. He thinks like, how can I, you know, she's how old? So I called him and had a one-way conversation where I just, you know, everything I'd rehearsed, I said in a really stilted, horrible way. And
he got on the phone.
And he said that, thank you so much. I will consider all those things.
Ugh.
And I was like,
so he knew exactly what you were calling.
Yeah. And so, and I was just like, consider. Okay. This is not going to go my way. This isn't going to go my way. I just knew it. And then my friend was visiting and I felt it go away. Like for a while, I think he really was. Everybody said that he was really torn when they let me go. But I felt it, you know, just in the atmosphere. I felt it move away from me at some point. And I hadn't talked to anybody. It had been like a couple of weeks later, you know. And I looked at my friend. I go, it's gone. It went away.
That is like a moment you have in a relationship as well.
Totally.
Where you're like,
they just fell out of love with me.
Yeah.
They found a shinier object. And then I know Nassim from Groundlings, and she was in the side lead company there. So I was stoked for her, and Jenny I didn't know, but I knew people who knew her, and they all just adored her. And when I looked at them, I looked at their picture. I was like, yeah, they don't need me anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And I was so sad, but I was like getting emotional now. I was really sad because I just. There's this thing where you don't know why, you know? And I was like, did I say something? Did I do? It's so
horrible.
You
want to blame yourself.
Well, because, you know, who knows? I joke, maybe I said something that people misinterpret me constantly because I have a joke in my head, but it doesn't come out of my mouth the right way. And maybe that happened and then I heard, maybe it was on your show. I heard Andy Samberg, I think, talking about Lorne likes to hire people he'd want to go on a road trip with. It was something like that. Like he could imagine that he'd be happy to be on a cross-country road trip with. And I heard it on your show and it was like, you know, years later, of course. And I heard it. I was like, totally over it. You know, fine. Don't care. My life is, you know, found where actually, which is another story, but I feel like things do happen for a reason. And, retroactively, I feel like I'm glad things went the way they did. But at the time, you know, you feel so much rejection. And I was hearing that and I was like, I wonder if Lorne was like, I don't want to go on a road trip with that chick. That made me so sad.
But you did that
to
yourself.
I'm great on a road trip. No, I'm just kidding. Because I think I'm funny. My friends think I'm funny. No,
there's nothing else you can do with that information. But ultimately, I imagine you realize on some level that, you know, the machinations of that thing they're fairly complicated.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's just some weird personal.
But you're going to.
Of course.
Your GPS is going to be like, where's the.
Because you did good work.
Total shame.
You know, it wasn't like you tanked.
Right.
You're funny.
Yeah. And, you know, and hopefully he's like, oops, shouldn't have let that, you know, maybe like you hope your ex-boyfriend pines for you.
You know what? And if I ever get a chance to talk to him, which I've been beating around the bush for, you know, or 6 years now. It may never happen. It may be the white whale.
Happened?
I don't know. I mean, maybe I haven't tried hard enough.
But like, I also don't know what I'm looking for. I, you know, at the time that I went in there, you know, I was unformed. Mm-hmm. I was chaotic. Mm-hmm. I was probably looking for a parent. You know, there was a lot of things that were going on mm-hmm. that would, you know, lead to me not getting the show. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure what I really want out of him now.
Right.
You know, like, you know, I've talked to everybody about him. I've told my story about auditioning a million times. Everyone knows it who listens to this show. Mm-hmm. But the worst thing that could happen is, and I, you know, if he gives a shit at all, mm-hmm. the worst thing that could happen if I interview him is nothing. Like, they, you know, like if I, you know, I sort of remember you coming in, but not really.
Oh,
you know,
my
like,
God. So exactly. Exactly.
So, you know, there's part of it that, but I'd also like to interview him for the scope of, you know, his career. I mean, I would give him a great interview, but I do have these.
And that is the truth of it. And I think that's why I felt sad if, like, this guy doesn't want to be on a road trip with me, which we don't know. Maybe he can't wait to get on it. Maybe he's going to call me and say, let's go.
We're going up the coast.
We're doing the Dakotas. But he is, I have such respect for him. And he tells such a great story. And when I watch him, you know, there at work and I observe him and I just see how he handles things, I am enamored with him.
Of course.
A bit. And
yeah.
So, you know, the truth is, like, I was so shocked and sad, sort of, but I didn't allow myself to feel sad because I was like, well, I was happy I got to go. You know, I was in this real, like, gratitude place, brimming, overflowing with it. Just the fact that I got to go,
yeah.
It felt like it never felt real. It always felt surreal the entire time. So it wasn't until, you know, a year later that I started to realize I was hurt and sad by that. But I was back buying my costumes at Goodwill, doing shows at the Growlings. You know, it was very humbling, and but it was ultimately very good for me. I mean, it made me appreciate my friends. It made me appreciate, which I already did, but it made me even more. Mm. Just organize what's important.
And also, like,
organize what's important. The Groundlings is such an important part of my life.
But, you know, you have a tremendous amount of genuine earned humility.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you found, you know, your like soulmate in Jill.
Yeah,
and then, you know, you do great work that you have control over.
I never would have
over.
Met my husband if, and
yeah,
he's
and also
the love of my life, you know.
Yeah, and, I mean, and you work,
and I work, and I'm doing what I want to do.
I can totally relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, like, I don't know if I'd been given all the opportunities mm-hmm. that you want in show business, you know, what kind of person would you be, and would you be able to make the same choices?
Right.
You know what I mean? It's you do lose a lot of free will in a way.
I remember every time I sat in a BMW, was like, I would just smell the leather and feel the fit and finish.
Yeah.
And then if you own one for it's a car. And right. I feel like if you have every job I have, I embrace it. I love the crew. I love the people. I love, you know, the words that I get to say. I love the whole experience of it because I appreciate the shit out of it. And that sounds so Pollyanna, but it's 100% true.
Well, I am a huge fan.
Oh, thank you. Likewise.
And this is a
no. Are you? I couldn't love you more right now. Ugh.
I don't even know why.
Why are you crying?
I don't know. Maybe it's my own shit. But thank you for talking to me.
Thank you.
Charming, touching, amazing, crying. That's our show. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get on that mailing list. Get a little justcoffee.coop. Get the WTF blend with my face on it, and I get a little something on the back end of that if that's a thing for you. Check the calendar. Check the guide so you know who's been on the show. Get the howl thing going. Howl. All right? Okay.
Let's play guitar, man.
Boomer Live!
lives.